This is the shocking story about how a Labour MP met the heart of political power by the name of Josh Simons, who before he became an MP decided it was a good idea to hire a reputation management firm to look into me, an investigative journalist looking into his organisation, Labour Together. About 4 years ago, I got access to a phenomenal leak of documents out of the Labour Party. That sparked my investigation into Morgan McSweeney and the Labour Party, an incredible story of the reckless and arguably lawless project that has delivered us this Keir Starmer government. In November 2023, the Sunday Times ran a front-page story based on the documents that I gave to it. It raised serious concerns about whether the donations that Morgan McSweeney had failed to report had not been reported on purpose. At the bottom of that article, it simply said that Paul Holden, that's me, had given certain documents to the Sunday Times and formed part of their investigation. On the 8th of February 2024, Pippa Creer, the deputy political editor of The Guardian, sent me an email. Pippa Creer's email said that The Guardian was 24 hours away from running a story that would allege that I was under investigation by the UK security services for receiving information stolen by Russia from a hack of the Electoral Commission. The story was nonsense. I hadn't received a single document from Russia. I would never receive a document from Russia. This is an unbelievable story. When I told Pippa Creer that the allegations were false, that in fact I would sue The Guardian for defamation if they reprinted that story, the story disappeared. Labour Together had tried to convince the National Cyber Security Centre to investigate me. I don't think they were very successful, as I've never heard from the NCSC, either before or after Pippa Creer's email. A couple of weeks after that, I got a phone call from an old friend of mine from South Africa, an absolutely fearsome investigative journalist. At the time, she'd been working on a series of stories about how there were reputation management companies in the UK who are hired by the likes of multinational companies, arms companies, BP, Shell, tobacco companies, to make sure their reputation isn't tarnished. Tarnished by people like me, by whistleblowers, people who report on corruption. She called me in 2024 and said, I should let you know, your name has come up in my investigation. You are the person of interest. They're doing investigations into you. They're trying to figure out who you are and who your family is. And I said to her, well, you know, who was the client behind this investigation? And she came back to me and she said, Labour Together. And I said, well, who's on these emails? A young man by the name of Josh Simons. Now, Josh Simons was the director of Labour Together between late 2022 and mid-2024.
To her right is Josh Simons, who is the director of Labour Together, a political think tank founded to make Labour electable again, that works closely with Sir Keir Starmer and his team. He first worked for Labour as a party staffer under Jeremy Corbyn before resigning over anti-Semitism.
During the 2024 general election, he was parachuted into a safe seat and now sits as a Labour MP, recently promoted by Keir Starmer, to its parliamentary secretary in the Cabinet Office.
We need to bring some integrity, some faith, some sense that politics is actually a profession of nobility to pursue that requires people of good character.
Frequently appearing on shows like Politics Joe, talking about how politicians have lost the trust of the public.
Trust in elected politicians, in the things that we say that we can do, in whether we actually want to do the things that we say we want to do, is so completely broken.
I wonder why. Between 2017 and 2020, Labour Together ran an undisclosed secret project to destroy the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn. With a pot of money, £730,000, Morgan McSweeney wasn't declaring as required by law to the Electoral Commission. What McSweeney did was produce a detailed presentation of what the Labour Party membership wanted and who they would vote for. They were able to present a pitch of Keir Starmer as a radical eco-socialist, an inheritor of the Corbynite tradition, that he will unite the party and end factionalism. But nothing could be further from the truth. The fraudulent pitch that Keir Starmer offered was based entirely on Morgan McSweeney's vision of him polling the membership, understanding what needed to be said to get Labour members to vote for a leader who would then betray them.
Keir had to win. That was the most important thing. And if in the Labour Party you win the leadership of the Labour Party, you quite quickly run the whole thing. You can take all the reins and you can take control over the whole institution and you can frankly smash the institution to pieces and rebuild it again. And that is what he did. And in order to do that, in order to do what he's done in a very, very short space of time, he had to be smart and strategic, as you always are in American politics. You start from the left and you tack to the center. That's how you win. Politics is about power. It's an all or nothing game.
That explanation rests upon two assertions. One is that he knew that Corbyn was going to lose. And the other is that he pretended to support him when he didn't really. How do you answer that?
Now, Josh Simons, before he became an MP, who was the director of Labour Together, had hired a firm that was looking into me, into my family, and into my colleagues. They used sophisticated data scraping tools and intelligence techniques to find out where and who I lived with. They had to do that because I've tried to keep that secret as I can, because I don't have social media. And I don't have social media because when I was in South Africa, those sorts of things were used to harass me, to find out where I lived, and to target me with targeted burglaries. I was told that the investigative firm that had been hired by Labour Together finally alighted on an incredible allegation that I was connected to Russian intelligence through South African intelligence structures, despite the fact that I spent quite a lot of my career investigating Russian oligarchs, and I've actually suffered a series of legal threats as a result. I was very aware, not just of how this would undermine my investigation into the Labour Party, but how it would really help some really gnarly people around the world. Money launderers, criminals, titans of industry, corrupt politicians. I believe that because for the last 15 years, I've worked as an investigative journalist focusing on grand corruption in my native country, South Africa. For the last 6 or 7 years, I've been working to investigate a well-known family called the Gupta family. The Gupta family, for years and years and years, worked with the presidency of Jacob Zuma to loot South Africa, to steal the money that's intended to uplift the poor and instead use it to host private weddings and live in luxury in Dubai. Together, I worked with law enforcement in South Africa to put together the definitive guide of how the Guptas had stolen their money and how they'd laundered their money abroad. For the last 3 years, I've been working with the National Prosecuting Authority in South Africa and multiple law enforcement agencies around the world to go after the Guptas' dodgy loot. And in that, we've been incredibly successful. To date, my work has led to the recovery of almost $1 billion in stolen assets that have been recovered in fines and asset forfeiture proceeds around the world. I knew that Pippa Kreyer's email and Pippa Kreyer's story would be an absolute godsend to those criminal actors that I was tackling in South Africa. They would present this and say, look, the guy who is central to these investigations, he's an agent. He's a Russian spy. You can't believe anything he has to say. It would fatally undermine a series of ongoing criminal prosecutions and investigations into some of South Africa's worst criminals. So you have a currently sitting Labour Party MP with considerable influence in the party, who before he became an MP decided it was a good idea to hire a reputation management firm to look into me, an investigative journalist, looking into his organisation, Labour Together. These reports don't say that what I've reported so far about the Labour Party, about Labour Together, and Morgan McSweeney is wrong. They don't say that my documents are not authentic. In fact, what I think they show is fear. What I think they show is that they're worried about what I have. They want to find out what else I'm going to reveal about the Labour Party, about Morgan McSweeney and Labour Together. And you know what? They're right to be scared. This is just a taste of the shocking and outrageous stories that I cover in my book, The Fraud, available now. One of the things that my investigation of the Labour Party has shown is that the thing that the Labour Party right wing absolutely cannot stand, it's the independent media, shining a light on their activities, holding them to account. One of the best outlets for that is Double Down News. So if you can, please support Double Down News by supporting their Patreon and following them online.
There's an end of days feel about the Starmer government at the moment. It's been absolutely buffeted by a series of scandals. There's a real sense of the government unravelling before our eyes. In the last few weeks, Keir Starmer has lost his deputy prime minister, his director of strategy, and now his ambassador to Washington. The Mandelson story really epitomises the moral and intellectual bankruptcy of this sort of very closed political media class that runs Britain at the moment. Trevor Phillips, who does Sky's key Sunday morning politics show, Peter Mandelson was best man at Trevor Phillips' wedding.
Good morning, Lord Mandelson.
Good morning.
Robert Peston from ITV is now saying, oh, why weren't questions asked? Peston had Mandelson on his show, didn't ask him a thing about Epstein. What he asked him about was the Labour MP, Andy MacDonald, having used a version of the expression, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free.
Your colleague, Andy MacDonald, who'd used that phrase, which many people think is anti-Semitic, from the river to the sea. Do you think he was too slow to remove the whip?
Not in the least, no.
Cathy Newman and myself were always very frustrated, you know, having revealed 6 years ago that Jeffrey Epstein referred to Peter Mandelson as Petey. It was always quite extraordinary. You would see Mandelson interviewed again and again. He was frequently in the media and eventually, of course, got this plum job in Washington. He was never queried on it. It was a question he was never asked.
Pleased to say Lord Mandelson is with us. Thank you for joining us, my lord.
Firstly, the sort of elephant in the room here is that Mandelson was a master of the dark arts.
I'm now the Dark Lord, by the way, not the Prince of Darkness.
So, I am now...
Prince of Darkness. As you can see, I exude light.
Transparency.
Transparency and bonhomie. Yeah.
They appointed him to Washington, not despite this. It's because of this. Precisely because he was the type of man he was that they thought he'd be useful for dealing with Trump. That's why they appointed him.
What a beautiful accent. Eh? I'd like to have that accent. Thank you.
My mother would be proud.
Here you have a man who has spent a lot of time with Epstein. Who knows what Epstein knows about Mandelson? Jeffrey Epstein clearly had connections in the world of intelligence. Very, very likely he had connections to Mossad. You can certainly see how the whole thing could ring alarm bells from a security perspective.
The security services did raise concerns about the potential appointment of Peter Mandelson, Lord Mandelson, as ambassador in Washington, as Britain's person in the US. However, Number 10 overrode those concerns and appointed him anyway.
It now emerges that Peter Mandelson and he were very close friends, and they were spending Christmas together. They seem to have spent Epstein's birthdays together. Jeffrey Epstein had 2 massages a day from underage girls. It's very hard to see how anyone could spend any time with Epstein without realizing the centrality of underage girls in his lifestyle. The revolting thing about the birthday book, Jeffrey Epstein's lifestyle, is clearly a sort of inside joke. Peter Mandelson's entry is 10 pages long. He's taken the trouble to put 10 pages together. Pictures and then little statements underneath. He refers to Epstein as my best pal. That's under a picture of Peter Mandelson in a bathrobe sitting chatting to Jeffrey Epstein. He says, we love you. At the end of it, there's also a reference to the Epstein's wonderful houses, which he shares with his friends, and then in brackets, yum, yum, which is an extremely strange and rather disturbing thing to have said. When Epstein gets into trouble with the authorities in 2007, 2008, Mandelson is one of no doubt many men he turns to for help and advice. This is the extraordinary thing. It's not just that Mandelson maintains the relationship. Mandelson is intimately involved and is advising Epstein on how he can fight these charges against him. These are emails from Mandelson to Epstein. And this one's February 2008, when Epstein is fighting the charges against him. Mandelson, you are fighting back, so you need strategy, strategy, strategy. Remember the art of war. And then after Epstein is finally convicted. Far from distancing himself from Epstein, Peter Mandelson writes, I think the world of you and I feel hopeless and furious about what has happened. I can still barely understand it. It just could not happen in Britain. You have to be incredibly resilient, fight for early release and be philosophical about it as much as you can. Everything can be turned into an opportunity and that you will come through it and be stronger for it. The whole thing has been years of torture, and now you have to show the world how big a person you are and how strong. Your friends stay with you and love you. Where does this story go from here? Firstly, there continue to be very awkward questions for Keir Starmer to answer about what he knew when, but I think it ripples out beyond that. There's a couple of stories that have just not been picked up on at all. People keep talking about how Mandelson maintained his relationship with Epstein after he had been convicted of the crime of molesting young girls. Now, we've known that for ages. What emerged in the reporting was that he not only retained that relationship, he was actively working to help Epstein get off the charges. I mean, the emails are quite extraordinary. One very interesting thing he does, Epstein writes to him in the summer of 2008 and says, your man, Gordon Brown, then Prime Minister, is meeting with Bush in Washington in a few days. Could he put in a word for me with Bush's chief of staff? Mandelson doesn't come back and say, no, that would be completely inappropriate. He comes back and says, actually, the meeting's already happened and the relevant person wasn't there and so on. So clearly that didn't go anywhere. But it's very revealing that Epstein was even asking that of him. It suggests that Mandelson was prepared to use his connections to the heart of power to try and help Epstein in his legal difficulties. And it does raise the question, did Peter Mandelson simply share the view that Epstein and others around him had that these girls just didn't matter? They were just sort of expendable. It's also a really interesting story that almost no one's picked up on in the Times The Times revealed that there was a memo that has been suppressed. It's not been released to the public. It's a memo from Peter Mandelson to Tony Blair, in which he recommends that Blair meets this man, Jeffrey Epstein. Not for any particular reason. There's nothing to discuss. He simply thinks that Epstein would be an interesting person for Blair to meet. Now, that in itself is very interesting. The Times then does a rather odd thing. It says it is unclear if any meeting took place. And you're thinking, well, didn't you ask? I mean, the absolutely blindingly obvious thing to do in the wake of that is to fire off a message to the Tony Blair Institute. Have you ever met Jeffrey Epstein? This links very directly to the present government. Firstly, extremely influential within the present government is the Tony Blair Institute advising the present government. Blair and Mandelson, obviously very, very close. But also, I think the broader British public still hasn't quite grasped the degree to which the country is actually run by Morgan McSweeney. Every time there is a reshuffle of government, every time there's a reorganisation in Downing Street, the word is that Morgan McSweeney is absolutely central to it, quite possibly advised by Peter Mandelson. I think Starmer worked out very early on that he himself has no political instincts. He therefore decided to farm out that whole thing to Morgan McSweeney. The reporting is that McSweeney was absolutely central to getting Mandelson appointed and for sticking up for Mandelson throughout, which certainly calls into question McSweeney's political instincts. Mandelson is widely reported to be McSweeney's mentor. McSweeney is basically mini Mandelson. He is the person he sort of models himself on. So this scandal takes us right to the very heart of the Starmer administration. This idea that Starmer is now putting out, goodness me, how could I possibly have known I was misled by Peter Mandelson? We're very sceptical of that because, for starters, in our film in 2019, we exposed the links between Mandelson and Epstein. We interviewed this very interesting man. He was an anonymous interviewee. He appeared in silhouette with his voice disguised. Very interesting man, very, very wealthy man, had some interesting connections with the intelligence services himself, a good friend of Epstein's. He owned his own yacht and used to visit him. The story he told us was that he was visiting Epstein while Epstein was supposedly in prison in January 2009. The phone rings, and on the other end of the phone is this gentleman who Epstein keeps referring to as Petey. And it's only as the conversation goes along that our man, that our source, realizes this man is Peter Mandelson. And it's quite clear that he and Epstein are very, very close. The content of the phone conversation is interesting as well. Mandelson is calling to ask Epstein to fix up a meeting with a very, very senior banker in New York. And Epstein agrees to, and the meeting is indeed arranged.
Petey wanted to meet Jamie Dimon, who was then the chairman of J.P. Morgan. And by the time he said, yes, I'll sort it out, put the phone down, and Petey turned out to be none other than the Secretary of the Board of Trade, Peter Mandelson. I was astonished that a British cabinet minister at that time, probably the most powerful man other than the Prime Minister, was calling Jeffrey in jail to make an appointment or to seek an appointment with a very powerful banker in New York.
When we put this allegation to Peter Mandelson, his response was he could not recall this conversation, which is revealing. It's not a denial. He also pointed out, why would I need Jeffrey Epstein to fix up a meeting for me in New York with a senior banker? Peter Mandelson was a very senior member of the British government at that time. He had a whole office to do these things for him. The answer to that is, why indeed? Clearly, it seems that for whatever reason, Peter Mandelson wanted to have this meeting off the books, as it were, which was in itself interesting. So it was quite clear to us that Jeffrey Epstein and Peter Mandelson were close. Having said that, I was surprised by how close. I mean, the birthday book is extraordinary. But also the other emails. Bloomberg supposedly have 18,000 emails. I would be amazed if there isn't more material about lots of people within those emails. And I'm rather struck that Bloomberg doesn't seem to be making much of them at the moment. I'd love to get my own hands on those 18,000 emails. The whole business of Mandelson is drawing attention to the whole business of the dark arts of the Labour right, which was really what the Labour Files was an expose of. The Labour Files we made in September 2022, that's when it went to air. We'd been leaked the entire server of the Labour Party, so it was based on that. And we were able to pick apart in detail detail what had actually happened during the Corbyn years, and particularly the sort of campaign of sabotage that was really waged by the Labour Party bureaucracy. The Labour Party was interesting. It was absolutely ruthlessly ignored by the entire media. But since the Labour Party went out, there's a whole sort of body of literature and a body of work building up, which is sort of amplifying the narrative. I'll tell you something interesting about the Paul Ovenden story. Ovenden's messages are separate from the very large WhatsApp chats, which were included in the leaked report back in 2020, and which we drew on for the Labour files. First thing to say, it comes from Paul Holden's book, The Fraud. Within number 10, they're clearly in an absolute panic about the fraud and what else it might have in it. Newsnight and a couple of other national news outlets had photocopies of the Ovenden emails before the last election. Okay. Now, at that time, the problem was they didn't have verifiable electronic versions of it, which made it slightly difficult to report, although they perhaps could have made more effort. But they knew about it before the last election. Now, the BBC Newsnight was then approached again on July the 17th, almost 2 months before the story finally broke. And this time, verifiable electronic versions of the texts were available. And basically, Newsnight sat on it for a very long time, umdenard, and then in early September decided not to go with it. It was handed to ITV. ITV ran it within a week of being handed it. Now, even then, there's an interesting story about what happens. ITV gives number 10 24 hours notice. Number 10 then wields a damage limitation exercise. Now, there's only so much they can limit the damage. Ovenden has to resign pretty much immediately anyway. But they hand the story to sympathetic journalists and frame it in as sympathetic a way as they possibly can. The deputy editor of The Guardian, accompanying her own story on this, is putting out posts on X, which are essentially presenting Ovenden as a victim. So there's then a concerted and coordinated pushback, which echoes Ovenden's own point that it's chilling that he should have to resign for comments 8 years ago in a private chat. There is a general pushback, banter. It's banter. The comments by Ovenden, and more broadly, the way Diane Abbott has been treated in the media, but also within the Labour Party, by the right of the Labour Party, is so disrespectful. It really is revolting. As I say, actually read Ovenden's comments, what it is he says about her. And she, of course, is the one who continues to be suspended from the Parliamentary Labour Party. Diane Abbott's had the whip removed. A number of other Labour MPs have had the whip removed on points of principle for opposing things like the two-child benefit cap. While Peter Mandelson is a peer for life, Mandelson has clearly been very influential within Starmer's team for quite some time. Eventually was appointed to this plum job in Washington, while at the same time, the party was suspending people like Jeremy Corbyn.
Let me be very clear about that. Jeremy Corbyn will not stand for Labour at the next general election as a Labour Party candidate.
Even as Mandelson was saying, oh, there's more to come.
I have no doubt at all that there's a lot of traffic, correspondence,
emails,
exchanges,
letters
between us. Absolutely. And we know those are going to surface. We know they're going to come out. We know they're going to be very embarrassing.
Starmer was standing up in the Commons to defend Peter Mandelson.
The ambassador has repeatedly expressed his deep regret for his association with him. He's right to do so. I have confidence in him, and he's playing an important role in the UK-US relationship.
It's quite extraordinary that Starmer was prepared to put himself on the line like that to defend Peter Mandelson. And it's extraordinary the lack of curiosity the media showed about Peter Mandelson, given his past. And in fact, their readiness to interview Peter Mandelson as an expert on issues such as anti-Semitism within the Labour Party.
When I look at the sort of anti-Semitic abuse to which Luciano Berger has been subjected, but not alone, many others in the party, I feel ashamed. I feel actually quite morally compromised.
Mandelson, a man who has been quite open about the fact that he worked, quote, day and night to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn.
You've said each day I try and think of ways to undermine Jeremy Corbyn.
I did say that, yes.
Well, that was a mistake, wasn't it?
Well, no, I wasn't alone.
If he'd had your backing, he might have done a lot better.
Well, he might have done.
I think the lack of scrutiny to which Mandelson was subjected is not accidental. It's symptomatic of a broader problem within British media. The political media class is drawn from a really quite narrow group of sort of middle-class professionals from very similar backgrounds, many of whom have never had a job outside of politics or journalism. And I think the Mandelson story is symptomatic of that. The last few weeks have shown the power of the media. I mean, when these things started getting reported, pretty much immediately Peter Mandelson loses his job. Paul Ovenden loses his job. In both cases, though, the media is handed these stories on a plate. So even when you spoon-feed the British media, the BBC sits on the Ovenden story for 2 months and doesn't publish it. You have this sense that the media was almost forced to report these stories in spite of itself. And it really does highlight the degree to which, up until now, the British media really hasn't been doing its job of holding the Starmer government to account. For years, it's been clear there are huge problems with Starmer, going right back to the funding of Labour Together, the organisation that propelled him to power, the funding of his own campaign to be leader of the Labour Party. Also, the very, very basic point that he stood on a series of pledges, every single one of which he broke. When you compare it with the scrutiny his predecessor, Jeremy Corbyn, had, is extraordinary the soft ride he had, to a degree that I think is actually very unhealthy in a democracy, and it partly explains why the Labour Party now finds itself in this dreadful position, being led in Parliament by a man who clearly simply isn't up to the job. Peter Mandelson is a case study in the British media's inability to properly scrutinise people in power. He's a case study of the unhealthy, cosy, closed world of the British political media class, which is precisely why you need independent outlets like Double Down News, and I would urge you to sponsor them on Patreon.